Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Hummingbirds, with their jewel-like plumage, acrobatic flight, and fearless character, have fascinated us for centuries. For hundreds of years, these mythic-like creatures have played a central role in the folklore and spirituality of many cultures. But the future of these amazing little spirits is endangered by climate chaos and human development. Today, we talk with nature writer and hummingbird obsessive John Donne, whose new book, The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds, describes his journey following the trail of these charismatic birds, the full length of their worldwide range, from Alaska to South America. John, welcome to Locus Focus.
It's great to be on the show, Barbara. Thanks ever so much for having me.
I have been a hummingbird freak since I was a little kid, ever since I studied birds in second grade. And I wanted to live around hummingbirds. And I think occasionally when I was little, I saw some ruby-throated hummingbirds, which was the endemic species of New England. Now I live in the land of hummingbirds. And as I was thinking about interviewing you, I was thinking, it's interesting that the difference between us is that I live surrounded by hummingbirds and have lived all my life in, it turns out, the hemisphere that has hummingbirds. Whereas you grew up away from hummingbirds, but you dedicated yourself to seeing just about every species you could possibly see in North and South America. So I'm envious about that.
Sure. I yearned for what I couldn't have. I was a little boy and taken up to London by my mother for a day out to see all the usual tourist stuff, you know, the black cabs, the red buses, the changing of the guard. And, you know, that stuff didn't really interest me. I wanted to, you know, be out in the countryside and see natural history and wildlife. And my mum was a savvy woman, and she knew that if she saved the Natural History Museum for the end of the day, she'd have complete compliance from me for the boring tourist stuff. Yeah, I went in there. I saw my first hummingbirds. They were stuffed, and they were taxidermied specimens. They're, you know, a sorry shadow of the real thing. But, you know, I'd never seen birds that looked anything like them before, and I wanted to find out more. And of course, this was the 1980s, so I took myself to the library and, you know, read anything I could find about them. And then every now and again, a David Attenborough show would come on the TV and I'd see actual moving hummingbirds. And oh my God, there was no bird like them. And it was just a matter of time, really, before I got myself out to America to see my first.
The first thing I learned from your book was that, and I didn't realize this, and most of my friends didn't realize this either, that hummingbirds only live in the Americas. I'm curious about why that is.
The hummingbirds surprised me throughout the course of researching the book. At every turn, they had something up their sleeve. There was something new to learn. And one of the amazing things I found out was that they're not even from the Americas. Sure, they're only found there now, but they're actually European originally. And which I found amazing, the oldest hummingbird fossils that have been found in the Americas are between 1 and 2 million years old. And some years ago, a German paleontologist was looking at these bird fossils that had been dug out of a clay pit in Germany. And he recognized the unique wing structure of these birds. And he realized they're hummingbirds. And these were some 30 million years old. So the original ancestral hummingbirds evolved in a much warmer, presumably, Europe than we currently have at the moment. And at some point in the intervening 30 million years, they crossed over to the Americas. Europe presumably had an ice age or two in the meantime, which did for them there. But thankfully, in the Americas, they'd found a place where they could blossom and evolve to the hundreds of species we have today.
So they actually flew across the Atlantic Ocean?
Well, I'm guessing they would have gone across the land bridge. Hummingbirds, some of them do fantastic sea crossings. You know, the ruby throats you mentioned seeing when you were young, you know, they regularly cross over the Gulf in the spring and fall migration. So they're amazing migrants, some of them.
Well, let's talk about why we are so intrigued by hummingbirds. And I find it interesting that I probably was around the same age as you when you encountered hummingbirds, only I was fortunate to be able to encounter the live ones. But there's something about hummingbirds that has always resonated with me on, let's say, a higher pitch than any other animal, I think, on Earth.
You and I are not alone in that. There's another nature writer, a friend called Tim Dee. He writes beautifully, and he said something to me in the last few months, and I thought that kind of nails it. He said hummingbirds are like other birds, like birds 2.0. And I thought, yeah, you're right. They're sort of birds, but more than birds somehow. And I mean, we can rationalize that with the sort of the hovering flight. It's unique, the way they can do that. And sure, they're really colourful, but then lots of birds are colourful and lots of birds have amazing flights and so on. And I think, and I thought I've given this a lot of thought, I met and heard from a lot of people who hummingbirds had touched them in their lives in particular ways. It might be that they'd grown up with them and these were the approachable birds which came into their yards. It might be a parent or a grandparent had retired somewhere and had formed a real relationship with the hummingbirds which came to the feeder in the outside their window. And the stories kept coming, and I realized that the hummingbirds touch people in a very specific way. And I thought about, you know, why is this? And I think, and there's not a scientific thing, I think it's because they are so approachable. Not every hummingbird, you know, some of them in South America are extremely shy, but often there will be species which come and approach us in a way that no other bird really does. In fact, really no other wild animals do. We've given them ample cause to treat us with caution. I was going to say respect, but I don't think we've earned, you know, wildlife's respect in any way, shape or form. But they approach us in a way which other creatures don't. And I think deep down, that's quite reassuring for us, because I think innately we know that we've given birds and animals ample cause to be fearful of us. And so to have something approach us and come and fly right up into our faces, or come right up to the window that divides us from the outside world from our house to our yard, I think that reassures us in some way that we're perhaps not so bad after all. And we feel a real bond and a connection with them. So I think it's that fearlessness they show which captures us in some deep way.
Well, I've often been out working in my garden, especially in the early evening, and I'll have hummingbirds just come right up to my face. I mean, they come up within inches of your face, and there's that buzzing sound. You're busy weeding and paying attention to the ground, and suddenly you hear this buzzing sound, and you look up, and there's this hummingbird. It's a very unique experience. I wonder if you can explain what it feels like when you have a hummingbird just suddenly right in your face.
Absolutely. I've had this happen a few times, but the one instance which really stands out, it felt otherworldly. And this was in Ecuador. I was traveling with a party of American birders, and we'd arrived at a lodge quite late in the afternoon, and everyone else had gone in to freshen up. But Mr. Hummingbird Obsessive here thought, no, there's a few minutes of daylight, I'm going out to look at the feeders. I was sat in the little glade they had outside the lodge, and you know, the feeders were hanging in the trees and the bushes, and you could hear the hummingbirds going to roost. You could hear a lot of the buzzing and chittering in the bushes, and there wasn't any activity. And I was just feeling very peaceful and looking back at the lodge and thinking, this is good. And then I heard this deep, sonorous buzzing. And, you know, it's clearly a hummingbird in flight, but it was louder than I'd ever heard a hummingbird. And I felt the draft of his wings as he passed around my head. And suddenly there was I'd urge your listeners to Google this bird. It's one of the best. A velvet purple coronet. They're a bird which, you know, the name is wonderful, and they more than live up to it in person. This sumptuous, metallic, royal purple bird just hovering just so close to my face. I could feel the draft from his wing beats, and I felt that deep connection. Time seemed to slow down in that moment. I felt touched by something otherworldly, very special. It was a really, really special moment.
Well, in our yard, we have been having hummingbird nests for a number of years. And actually, there was one that we discovered in April, I guess. And it was in a rather shocking place. It was in this rhododendron that's right by our front porch. And it was a pretty low-hanging branch that it was on, and it was very visible. And it was a very young bird. And first, a friend of mine actually spotted it as she was coming over to pick us up. And she said, there's a hummingbird in there. And I looked at it and went, no, this is actually a hummingbird nesting. So we watched her for about a week, and I was feeling very protective. One day, a neighbor cat came in the yard, and I was just like really wanting to protect this hummingbird. And then she disappeared for a couple days. And we were really worried about what had happened to her. And then she came back, and she was coming back, and she was carrying this white fluffy stuff in her mouth. And what it turned out that she did is that she was stuffing the nest. And then the last thing she did was to do this amazing dance where she was fluttering her wings at hummingbird speed and then dancing on this white stuff. And she had basically decommissioned the nest. I was reading up to try to find out if hummingbirds, like some other birds, will build multiple nests.
Would assume they probably do.
And my theory was, is that she was young, and I think she might have been born last year in a nest that was in a camellia around the corner. And I thought, well, maybe her mother came up to her and said, this is not a safe place for a nest. You need to build your nest higher up in the tree and, you know, out of sight. Our neighbors mentioned a couple weeks ago that there's a lot of hummingbird activity up in the top of our rhododendron. I couldn't see as well as I could from their bedroom window, but I could see that there was a lot going on. And actually, the other day, I saw one of the babies fly out of the bush and onto a telephone wire. So I know that they've hatched.
Oh, the moral to that story is that mothers always know best.
Well, a couple of years ago, it was another family that was living in our camellia in the front yard. And I was out reading about 7 o'clock in the evening. And suddenly there were these four hummingbirds, and they were just flitting around and flying around and flying around me. And I was weeding in the tomato patch, and they were like, they loved to get on the tomato cages. There was a male, a female, and then two young ones. And I thought, oh, it's the hummingbird family outing for the evening. And they're sharing it with me. And I've never had that experience with any other birds, that they would share their family outing with you.
That is tremendous. I love that. I really am so envious of you, Barbara, having them in your life on a day-to-day basis. I just dipped my toe in the, you know, into the pool and spent as much time as I could, of course, with birds. But yeah, I wish I had them at home. We have lots of wonderful wildlife where I live, but no hummingbirds.
Well, as much as I'm very happy to have all these mostly green hummingbirds living around me, the Annas, I am very envious of all the hummingbirds that you guys get to see on your trip. And I'm wondering what inspired you to actually decide to follow the hummingbird route from Alaska down to Tierra del Fuego.
I'm a naturalist. I'm a bit like a bowerbird. I like colorful things. So I think I wrote a book. My last book was all about orchids. I love beautiful flowers. And of course, the hummingbirds are their color alone, as well as the varied shapes of their plumage and so on, was innately attractive to me. But as well as being a naturalist, I'm a writer, and I love telling stories. And I love something which has a rich vein of material, which I can really dive into with quirky stories, fascinating scientific stories, you know, something which I can spin off in different directions. And so the more I had looked into hummingbirds from being a little boy right the way through to just a few years ago when I set off to do this hummingbird quest, I realized there was something really good here. And it felt like fate, really, because I live in the Shetland Islands. Where we are, we're actually we're north of the mainland of Britain, north of Scotland. We're kind of halfway across the North Sea between Scotland and Norway. So technically, we're actually closer to the Arctic Circle than we are to London. So we are really far north, 60 degrees north. And I discovered that the most northerly hummingbirds in the world, in the Americas, were at 60 degrees north in Alaska. And there was a little bit of me which thought, right, well, we're starting there then. I'm going to go from 60 degrees north in Europe to 60 degrees north in Alaska. And it really did feel fated, because I then discovered there was a story which was attached to that very place. The longest recorded hummingbird migration was a rufous hummingbird, which was ringed in Tallahassee in Florida, and was recovered. She was found with the band on her leg 3,500 miles north up in Alaska several months later. And so, you know, I thought, well, that's fantastic. I'd love to meet the person who actually, you know, found this hummingbird up there, which was what I did. I met Kate McLaughlin up there in Alaska, and I saw a female rufous hummingbird there. So it felt like a good starting point. And then, of course, you discover that hummingbirds are found in every possible habitat throughout the Americas. So it's amazing enough they're that far north, but they're found in deserts like the Sonoran Desert in Arizona. They're found right down at sea level and right the way up into the Andes, above the tree line, up in the Paramo. Some hummingbirds are virtually at the snow line, and they enter a state of torpor at night. They slow their heartbeats down from about 1,000 beats per minute during sort of daytime activity to below 100 beats per minute, and their body temperature drops to just a couple of degrees above the ambient air temperature. And so they're such incredibly adaptable things. And I realized that this meant that I could not only see the hummingbirds throughout the Americas and chase their stories, but also I was going to get to see so much of the Americas, so many different and diverse places, and meet so many really interesting people. And for a storyteller, this was a gift from the gods. So Yeah, that's where the idea of the story began, and I realized that, you know, this epic journey actually could be a really great travel and nature book rolled into one.
And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with John Dunn, who's the author of The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. Let's talk a bit about why hummingbirds are so amazing, besides the spiritual and energetic levels of them, but just in terms of their plumage. You talk a lot about the amazing ways that the light reflects the plumage in all these very multicolored, fantastically colored South American hummingbirds. Well, here in Oregon, our hummingbirds mostly seem to be green. But I actually discovered just the other day that the Anna that I thought was mostly green with just a little bit of red, that the male actually has a red head. I saw one pretty close the other day and the light shifted and suddenly it had a red head. So how does that work, that their plumage changes color?
So, yeah, they have iridescence, which most other birds, you know, you'll get, say, your warblers. Famously, for us European birders, American warblers are really colourful compared to our little brown grotty ones. So they're painted in almost primary colours. You know, they're bright, they're colourful, sure, but they don't do what that Anna's did, which you saw the other day. They don't have the iridescence, which makes their feathers flash and look metallic and sparkly. And this is something which researchers were looking at. Why are hummingbirds, how do they do this with their feathers? And it turns out that melanin, which gives our hair its color and also gives plumage of birds color as well, the melanin is actually formed in melanosomes, which are the little sort of cells within their feathers. Those melanosomes are shaped like pancakes, so little flat discs. And when the light strikes a hummingbird's feather, that allows the colors to iridesce. And the scientist who was describing this, and I was kind of struggling with the technical stuff because, you know, I'm a naturalist, but I'm not a scientist. And he used a really cool analogy, which I loved. He said, if you look at a bar of soap or a flake of soap, it's, you know, it's a white, dull thing. But when you spread it across the surface of a bubble, you know, it's suddenly the colors of the rainbow. So you can take one thing, it just depends how you present it for color and light to be perceived differently by the eye. And so the hummingbirds have evolved to have these amazing iridescent colors, particularly the males, although some of the females in some species also share that bright plumage. The Juan Fernandez firecrown, for example, out on Isla Robinson Crusoe is, for my money, even more beautiful than the male. They've done this for kind of two reasons, really. It's all about effectively sex and food. For the males, the bright iridescent plumage is used both to impress a mate, to display to a prospective partner, but also it's used in confrontation with other males to show the prowess and the strength and vigor of the bird in question. And that also extends to defending a food source, because anyone who's put a feeder up in their yard will know that some hummingbirds are particularly territorial around a feeder. The Rufus hummingbirds and Allen's hummingbirds, for example, they will not suffer another hummingbird anywhere near their food source. And a lot of that is display and bluster. And so they'll square up to one another. And their gorgets, their head and neck plumage, which is particularly iridescent, will be flared up to drive off and intimidate someone else who's thinking about having a drink of their nectar.
Well, I was wondering if the females are primarily green and kind of dull, if that's to protect them, particularly when they're brooding.
Absolutely spot on. Yeah, it's for sure. It's to be unobtrusive. The child rearing, as with so many birds, the weight of that falls to the mother hummingbird. And so, yeah, she's the one who's incubating and going off to feed the hummingbird chicks. So it makes complete sense when she's incubating or brooding her young that she is dull and green and drab on top, because looking from above, she's nesting amongst leaves in a tree or a bush or a shrub. And that kind of blends in. And similarly, from beneath, that white breast is, if you look up, you know, you often the sky looks fairly white when you're looking in a canopy situation. So, yeah, it's all about camouflage for the female.
It's also interesting. I noticed, like, the female that was sitting in the nest that was too close to the ground before her mother told her to move, that she looked black in a lot of light. And I would look at her, and sometimes she would shift, and suddenly she'd turn back to the more familiar green of the Annas. And I also noticed when they're sitting on telephone wires, they often look black. I had another interesting hummingbird experience last week. I was out at this place called Swan Island, which is once a verdant wetland in the Willamette River, which is now an industrial park. And they've filled and paved over a lot of what used to be the river. However, there was this hummingbird sitting right on the other side of the cyclone fence from where we were walking. And it's in an open area that looks like they might be trying to reforest it, or at least to renaturalize it. And it was in the single tree. And we spent a lot of time watching it. And as we were watching it, it kept changing colors. And we were trying to identify what it was, and we finally figured out, yes, it is an Annas.
Yeah, that's, I guess, part of the power of the iridescence is the fact that it's not, the color isn't permanently switched on. And so it really makes a statement when the light catches it at just the right angle. And of course, for you and I, just looking at a hummingbird, you know, as the bird shifts, it's not trying to display to us or warn us off. And so, you know, the colors will change and shift depending on our angle and the bird's angle. But when they're displaying, for example, to a female, you know, they'll very purposefully put themselves at just the right angle for the light to hit their gorget or their forehead at just the right angle that the female gets the full effect of that blazing color.
I was wondering if you had any opportunities while you were chasing hummingbirds throughout, particularly South America, if you got to see any of them nesting. Were you around at that time of year?
Yeah, I did come across a few hummingbird nests at various points. I certainly saw a lot of courtship flights, some of them, you know, display in different ways. Some will do large towering song flights. So the Annas particularly is famous for this. The male will fly up meters above the female and then tuck his wings in and dive down. And then at the very last minute, pull up, and he emits a chirping sound. And it turns out that it's not even coming from his syrinx, from his vocal organ. It's actually his tail that's making that noise. He's got a couple of tail feathers which chirp. They're like the reed in a woodwind instrument. You know, once the wind hits them at just the right angle, they make a noise.
So that you hear a lot, that's actually coming from their tail?
If it's at the end of a dive, then yes, that's actually the tail. I mean, they do chatter as well. They're quite capable of vocalizing from with their vocal organs, but in the display flight, the Annas are using their tails to do the talking. But I mean, that's amazing. But they're also pulling 9G, nine times gravitational force when they pull up. I obviously thought peregrine falcons were kind of the masters of the sky, but to learn that a hummingbird, a tiny little Annas hummingbird, is actually achieving the highest length specific velocity of any known vertebrate. And then 9G, that's what fighter pilots endure when they're flying fast jets. And that's a hummingbird. It's amazing. But to answer you, go back to your question about the nests. The sort of the poignant nest for me, I suppose, was when I was on Ilha Robinson Crusoe looking into the story of the conservation of the Juan Fernandez firecrown. And one of the guys who was working on the island looking to conserve the existing native forests and actually expand what's left, showed me a nest, an abandoned nest, and there was one egg in there. And he said, you know, we one day the female was there and then she was gone. And, you know, that particular bird failed, something happened. But it was fascinating to actually be able to really examine a hummingbird nest up close. You know, obviously when they're nesting, you know, you give them space, you're treating the birds with the deference and respect, of course, they deserve. But to actually look at that abandoned nest and see just how cunningly wrought it was from moss and bits of silk, spider silk, and to see that egg in there and how tiny it was, you know, it brings home to you just how delicate these birds are, as well as, of course, incredibly tough and enduring.
Well, how small is the nest?
Oh, my goodness. We're talking just a couple of inches across. You know, it's a tiny little thing. And I mean, the beauty of they're using spider silk to bind them together, and this is something which a lot of hummingbirds do, is it's incredibly strong stuff, but it's also quite elastic. And so if the egg had hatched, then, you know, that chick would have grown, obviously, as it neared fledging. And the nest can expand a little to accommodate that growing baby.
What do the spiders think of the hummingbirds stealing their webs?
Probably not a lot. But having said that, it does cut both ways. Some hummingbirds actually do, you know, get caught up in spider webs. If they happen to fly into a particularly tough web, then they can get entangled. I was chatting to a guy in Alaska who was recounting actually freeing hummingbirds from spider webs. And people have found dead hummingbirds hung in webs. Now, presumably a spider would, you know, welcome that big hit of protein if it could get a mandibles into it. And actually, you know, hummingbirds certainly have been seen being hunted by praying mantises. This is quite a regular thing by all accounts. You know, the mantids wait at feeders in the near tropics, and, you know, they're at least as big as some of the hummingbirds which come there, and more than capable of taking them. So if you're that small, if you're as tiny as a hummingbird, it's a big scary world.
Well, you talked about how fearless they are as well, and also talking about their territorialism. What I've witnessed with the hummingbird we have in our rhododendron is how protective they are of the nest. Because one day, a couple Oregon jays were flying around the rhodie, and immediately, and I think it was the male hummingbird, came dashing out and chased away two jays. And I thought that was a very interesting example of just how feisty and fearless hummingbirds are.
Absolutely. And I mean, what a wonderful thing to see for yourself. I certainly saw them defending the feeders against tanagers and other birds, which were really, they weren't interested in the nectar in the feeders. They were looking for fruit nearby. But if they passed too close to the feeders, yeah, the hummingbirds would square up to them. They're more than happy to take on birds significantly bigger than themselves.
Well, you write in your book about how they were iconic for Mesoamerican cultures, pre-contact cultures, and that they were seen as the warrior. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, the Aztec god of war, and I am not going to try and pronounce his name because there are a lot of vowels and consonants in a place which my European tongue isn't going to manage to do justice. But the Aztec god of war was a hummingbird. His name comes from the stem of the word for hummingbird at the time. And they obviously saw that sort of pugilistic aspect of the hummingbird and venerated it, and as something which they could see a quality in that which a warrior would reflect in the human world. But I mean, their feathers were kind of their undoing as well, that because they were so beautiful. The Aztecs in particular had a class of craftsmen called Amanteca, who created these amazing, all manner of things. They used feathers to cover shields for warriors to present formally in battle, but also there were cloaks of clothing. There were artifacts which had these feathers incorporated into them. And when the Spanish conquistadors came to subsume the Aztec Empire, they obviously were unfortunately attracted by the loot they could take from the empire, the spoils of war, the gold, the gems. But they also saw these amazing feather works which the Amanteca had created, and they turned the Amanteca to producing similar works of great art and artistry, but with the Catholic Church in mind. So they started to create Christian icons. And many of these actually survive in museums around the world to this day. One of the popes at the time couldn't believe that these wonderful representations of Christ and the Virgin Mary actually were made of feathers. He insisted on touching them. And this is recorded in sort of the archives at the time. And to this day, if you shine a LED light on some of these tiny little icons of the crucifixion, so on, the feathers still flare with that color which those centuries ago birds bestowed upon the craftsmen.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with John Dunn, who's author of The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. As you're describing the lure of the feathers and how they have probably led to the death of many hummingbirds, you described something else in your book which was very shocking, and I never heard about the feather trade for hats. as we get into the sad part of our story now, we talk about the challenges for hummingbird survival. Let's talk about some of these earlier challenges. And it's amazing that the hummingbirds survived them.
Yeah, murderous millinery. It's a dark chapter in the hummingbird story. And yeah, I guess it makes for a dark digression in The Glitter and the Green too, because in the 19th century, there were hummingbirds killed in their millions in South America in particular, and shipped back to Europe. Well, not just to Europe. They went to London and Paris, but also to New York. And these were effectively the big metropolises of the day, but they were also the sort of epicenters of the millinery trade. And there were what were known as feather foundries in New York's Lower East Side, but they also had their counterparts in London and in Paris. And there were auction houses which would sell, and the figures are staggering when you see the details of these auctions and the lots that the transactions which took place. They were selling hummingbirds in lots of their tens of thousands. And over the course of a year, hummingbirds were sold in their millions in these places. And they were bought by these feather foundries, which were effectively, they were sweatshops. They were places where very poorly paid, mostly women, were employed to create beautiful millinery hats. And also, because hummingbirds were so tiny, they also turned their attention to turning them into brooches, into earrings, jewelry, effectively. And because hummingbirds were so small, they were quite cheap to buy, and they were used as a cheap fix for an old hat. So you might be a fashionable lady who had a wonderful hat, but it was, you know, two seasons out of date, but you could zazzle it up with some hummingbirds. And there was a quote in the Times of London where the correspondent in the late 1800s wrote about how even the poorest girl from the slums could afford a couple of pennies to buy a hummingbird to brighten her bonnet. So the poor things were incredibly consumable. There was a sort of a positive legacy, though, from all of this, because, I mean, they weren't alone. There were egrets, the beautiful plumes of herons and egrets, the birds of paradise from Asia, birds from all over the world, flamingos and so on. Anything with bright, colourful and particularly architectural feathers, ostriches, for example. All of these creatures, all these birds were slaughtered in their thousands or millions, hummingbirds amongst them. And there were some people who felt this was morally repugnant and were appalled at the scale of the slaughter, both in Britain, but also they had their counterparts in the USA as well. And these concerned women banded together in the UK and formed what went on to get a royal charter and become the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. And in the States, their counterparts were a driving force behind the formation of the National Audubon Society. Those deaths were ghastly, of those millions of hummingbirds, but in a sense, they weren't entirely in vain, because we ended up with our respective bird conservation bodies born from that slaughter. And anyone who's listening to this, if they want to read all about the formation of these societies from this murderous millinery, there's a fabulous book which is just being republished in the UK called Etta Lemon by an author called Tessa Bose. So I do recommend that your listeners have a read of that as well. It's a fascinating deep dive into the feather trade.
I think it's interesting that John Audubon, who was partly responsible for forming the Audubon Society and a very famous bird painter, but he painted his birds from stuffed dead birds, didn't he?
Yeah, and it was, I mean, while at the same time that these birds were being slaughtered for hats, there were also I hesitate to use the word gentleman because it infers some sort of nobility, but there were men of money in Britain, but also in Europe, in France and Germany, who collected hummingbirds in the same way that they would collect, I don't know, orchids or beautiful seashells or curiosities. And they had these things, cabinets of curiosity. And I suppose it was the done thing that, you know, you would have your gentleman friends around for the port in the, you know, after dinner, and you'd show off your collection of hummingbirds. And some collectors were sort of more successful than others, or more obsessed perhaps than others, and had collections which ran to hundreds of species. and became sort of monomaniacs collectors, one of whom was a guy called Lodiges, who ended up with a bird named after him, the marvelous spatule tail. It's Latin, its scientific name is Lodigesia. But he, interestingly, to come back to Audubon, he actually was the guy who supplied Audubon with some of the specimens of hummingbird, which were actually sent from Britain out to the States for Audubon to paint them, even though they'd actually come from the States originally to be, you know, enter into this guy's collection. And Audubon sort of thanked him for supplying him with, I think it was Anna's hummingbird. So there they are again, they crop up again in our chat.
Another hummingbird that used to be pretty frequent around Oregon was the rufous hummingbird. We used to have a bunch of those in our yard in the spring. They would come before the Annas. The rufous have pretty much disappeared. I've seen them on the Oregon coast, and I see them very occasionally in our yard. The Annas now, instead of being migratory, are here year-round. And this seems to be the creeping shadow of climate change. So first of all, I wanted to talk about what's happened to the rufous, because I understand that they are becoming closer and closer to actually being listed as an endangered species.
Like so many declines of wildlife of all kinds, there's probably no black and white simple answer for the decline of the rufous hummingbird. It's probably a reflection of a combination of factors. Certainly what you saw years ago is this of the shifting baseline syndrome, because what you saw was still a shadow of what they once were. So you read contemporary accounts from the 1800s, and people recalled them at a scarcely credible 1,000 birds per acre. And I mean, we'll allow for some exaggeration, but they were clearly super numerous. So what's changed? Certainly the habitat has changed. There's probably much less native flowery meadow and a lot more arable land, which once was super suitable for hummingbirds, no longer is. Almost certainly the use of herbicides in agriculture throughout their range, not just in their breeding range in the US, but also in their wintering range in Mexico. The use of herbicides probably has reduced the amount of native wildflowers, which again they use. But also, and this flips to the story of the Annas, climate change is obviously changing their migratory patterns too, and where they're found. They were always traditionally a wintering species in Mexico, which would then come up into North America to breed. But now they're wintering in Florida. Now something's changed there. But the Annas, as you so rightly say, they've gone from being an irregular species to now being there. And this is the case right way up in Alaska as well. When I was chatting to people there, they would say, we'd get the odd Annas, as a vagrant, and now they suspect they're breeding there. They've obviously pushed their range north, and it's okay to sort of think, well, okay, maybe they're a winner of climate change. They're expanding their range. Maybe that's a good thing, but you have to look at perhaps some of the hummingbirds which have much smaller and much more localized populations in the Americas, the ones perhaps in the Andes, which are found in one particular valley of the Andes, or one particular slope of a particular range of the Andes. And where climate change or habitat change is forcing these birds from where they formerly were, they've got nowhere to go. Their migration might just be up and down slope in a particular elevation of the Andes, and once they run out of habitat, that's it. They've nothing left. So yeah, this as you rightly say, this is also getting onto the bleaker stuff. It's not all sort of fun and sun in the hummingbird's world. There's problems too. And we're just beginning to grasp what the extent of those problems are. The obvious thing is to notice the lack of rufous hummingbirds compared to 20, 30, 40, 100 years ago. But what's causing that? That's more complex. And unfortunately, probably the responsibility rests with us all and our ancestors.
It seems to me that as Portland has been working a lot more on establishing more natural habitat within the city and protecting areas like the Oaks Bottom Wildlife Refuge, which I live near, in Selwood, that there's an abundance of birds in particular, and actually this deer, we have a lot more deer living in the city, and of course more coyotes, this beaver that lived down in Oaks Bottom, and it has an amazing array of hummingbirds. I mean, it probably is the highest concentration of hummingbirds I've seen anywhere except for Bird Creek Meadow up in Mount Adams. When the wildflowers are in full bloom, there's an amazing amount of hummingbirds there. But it seems like the Annas have really multiplied in the last 28 years that I've been living here. Like, I know that there were at least 15 nests a couple summers ago down in Oaks Bottom. There's a woman I love down there. She's the hummingbird godmother. And I've learned a lot about hummingbirds from her. One of the things, though, I feel limited because really, basically, I see Annas and an occasional rufous. And there's other parts of the Americas where there's a lot more hummingbirds. I wanted to talk about some of these other hummingbirds that are maybe even more fantastical than the hummingbirds we have here in Oregon.
You need to get yourself down into Ecuador and Colombia, especially. It's also the neotropics are lusher, more biodiverse. There is just a lot more life there. And I have to say that the first time I set foot in Ecuador, which was my first real experience of that Andean biodiversity, it's overwhelming, the amount of life of all kinds. And that's just so special and wonderful. Because of the massive range of height and height, which actually has all sorts of different types of plant proliferating in it, you're talking thousands of meters of different habitats, which incrementally change. The ability for all species of all kinds, not just hummingbirds, to actually, or families of creature, to speciate and become so diverse is enormous. And this is why of the 300 plus species of hummingbird, most of them are clustered in the near tropical zone. And yeah, they've got obviously colors and plumages which are so wildly different and have such exuberance, but also physiological differences too. So you've got things like the sword-billed hummingbird, which has a preposterously long bill, longer than its body. It's a crazy looking thing. And this is so it can feed in really deep trumpeted flowers. And then again, you've got sickle bills, which there's a couple of species of them, which have a bill that's so curved in the shape of a sickle, effectively. It looks almost deformed. And yet this fits exactly into the sort of the waxy bracts of a heliconia flower, like a lock and key. And then you've got some hummingbirds, which are just outright thieves. There are wedge bills, which don't bother with the whole transaction of trying to feed from a flower and inadvertently pollinating it. They just hack the system. They just puncture the flower at the base and just suck nectar and give nothing in return. So yeah, the variety of hummingbirds there is absolutely off the scale, and in a presently almost unimaginable future when we can all travel again. I do urge people to go to these places. Actually, I think this is important because this was something I saw for myself, where people who otherwise might be turning habitat to growing coffee or, you know, more illicit substances still than coffee, where they can actually see that there is value in conserving native vegetation and habitat, because people who like us will come and actually pay money to stay in that area and see those wonderful creatures they've got there. You know, that actually places some economic value in wildlife, which might not otherwise be there. And I think in the world we live in, that is important now. We should all conserve everything simply for the sake of biodiversity. Of course we should. But the reality is that for some, you know, that's not necessarily as an option if you've got a family to feed. But if someone's going to come and see the marvelous spatula tail on your land, that's a powerful thing. So yeah, if you can go to see them, go and see these birds. They're really special.
We're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And we're talking today with John Dunn, who wrote a book called The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. You sort of alluded to something just now that seems to be a really serious problem with protecting hummingbirds, and that is the loss of habitat through all kinds of development, whether it's paving over Swan Island here in Portland or whether it's coffee plantations and other things that are happening in Latin America. So let's talk about some of the biggest threats to hummingbirds right now and then how that can be addressed.
Yeah, the latter bit, how it can be addressed, I don't have any ready answers necessarily. But yeah, the threats, we can see them, we can quantify them. Unfortunately, simple history and geography tells us what has been lost. Habitat loss is a massive factor. Well, Theodore Roosevelt, when he traveled in Brazil, he wrote a really fascinating account of his travels there. And one of the interesting sort of asides, when he wasn't hunting big game or, you know, providing interesting insights into the people he was traveling with, he also kept returning to extol the economic development potential of Brazil. And I think that this is something which has played out right across South America since Europeans settled there centuries ago, and those countries have continued to be seen as, you know, as places to exploit in one way or another. And a good example of this back in Brazil is the Atlantic Forest, which is now, I think some 90% of its former range is just gone. It's now agricultural land. And, you know, you have to imagine just the sheer scale of what biodiversity was lost in there. And, you know, 2 years ago, elsewhere in Brazil, in the Amazonian basin, Bolsonaro was extolling, you know, the virtues of the days of fire to clear forest for agriculture. And at the same time, of course, and this, you know, got rather lost in some of the rhetoric about burning the Amazon, but also he was undermining the legislative protection that indigenous peoples still had there. And so he was opening up the Amazon for economic development, whether it was agriculture or mining, looking for oil or minerals and so on. So, yeah, if I'm going to find that one sin which is driving all of this habitat loss anywhere, I guess it has to be economic development, whether it's someone, you know, doing something on that sort of large political scale as a president of a country, or whether it's actually someone who's wanting to grow coffee to, you know, sell as a cash crop in the local town to feed their family. So I feel very uneasy about economic development generally. I think we need, and this goes for us all across the world, to reappraise just how we consume stuff, and try and be more mindful about how we do that. But none of this escapes the fact there are an awful lot of us, and yeah, we all want more stuff. And to go back to your question about, you know, what can we do about these problems, I don't really have an answer. I wish I did.
Do you mention people in your book who are doing the best, particularly, I think, in Chile and in Ecuador, you mentioned it, and I think even in Colombia?
Oh, yeah, very much so. And that's really, you know, I did see wonderful examples of people in very local specific situations, great conservation work. And, you know, some species, example, to go back to Peru again, the marvelous spatula tail at one point, you know, it was...
Just describe that bird.
Okay, yeah. I mean, the name alone, you're expecting something pretty amazing, and it is. It's a tiny little pom-pom of a body. I'm going to describe the male because it is the male which is the most dramatic of the two genders. A tiny little pom-pom of a body, barely the size of a small ping-pong ball. He's got a sort of a black and white front, still, you know, quite understated, lovely turquoise shiny area around the face, but the drama is behind him, and this is the spatula tail. These are two amazingly long, thin, spine-like filamentous tail feathers, and at the end of each, there's a circular sort of dark midnight purple or blue iridescent disc of feather. And these are the spatules. And he uses these to display to a female. He'll hover in front of her and bend his tail around his body like a lyre, in that sort of shape, and then quiver those discs in, you know, towards her. Worth a Google. There's a brilliant BBC bit of footage narrated by Attenborough showing this display happening in a sort of wonderful lichen encrusted sort of amphitheater in the bushes. And yeah, it's just absolutely epic. An amazing bird. It's found in one river valley in Peru, and there only, as far as anyone's aware. And this is something which, yeah, people have started to place some value in the bird and some pride in the bird. There was a time when the young men would hunt them with slingshots or catapults. And it was actually reputed that the hummingbird's heart was a powerful aphrodisiac. So, you know, there was some cultural stuff going on there. But there was also just the simple fact that at one point a lot of land was being turned to grow marijuana and latterly coffee. And, you know, this was a bird which was looking like its habitat was going to run out. That's kind of changing a bit there. In Ecuador, there's a puffleg where, and this is another hummingbird which has the name kind of describes it, these amazing fluffy bloomers around its legs. And there's a project there where local conservationists have identified the particular species of native plant which the hummingbirds prefer. And local women are now growing them in a nursery, and they're being planted back into land which had formerly been cleared for agriculture. We come back to that wonderful island, which I keep returning to because I think it's perhaps my favourite place I visited. I have islands in my blood. Isla Robinson Crusoe for the Juan Fernandez Firecrown. And there's a conservation body who actually work throughout the Americas, including in the US, called Oikonos. They're based there and they're on Isla Robinson Crusoe, and they're doing work to try and address some of the pressures which that particular Juan Fernandez Firecrown is under. And actually, this is kind of that particular bird is a kind of a parable or a metaphor for a lot of hummingbirds, because it kind of has the perfect storm of man-induced problems that it's up against. There are rats introduced to the island by early Spanish and British sailors who put in there to stock up with fresh water and food. So the rats are a major predator of nesting birds. They actually climb in the trees. They're getting quite arboreal, the rats there. There are also goats, which the Spanish put onto the island so that they'd have fresh meat they could hunt when they came back a couple of years later with their boats. And goats are kind of like Agent Orange for all vegetation. They're just terrible. They're absolutely indiscriminate in what they eat. But since people have actually lived on the island, they've also bought cows, they've bought sheep, they've got horses. So all of these herbivores putting tons of pressure on the native vegetation. At some point in the 20th century, someone thought it would be a great idea to introduce from the South American mainland coatim mundi, which are like a big omnivorous creature which just, yeah, it can climb, it'll eat anything it can get its claws and paws upon. Worse still, because there were all of these herbivores introduced on the island, another islander thought it would be a great idea to introduce brambles, sort of prickly blackberry bushes, to make a lovely stock-proof fence around his vegetable garden, which would actually have some nice fruit he could eat as well. And these things have spread like topsy across the island, and they're smothering and out-competing the native vegetation. And there are feral cats as well, so, you know, just another problem. And because there are so many rodents, the islanders are loath to get rid of the cats because, you know, they want the cats to keep the rats and the mice out of their houses. And so the hummingbirds are under so much pressure that, and it was estimated when I went there were 1,000 individuals left, which isn't many. But when I was talking to the guys from Oikonos who are trying to address some of these issues in you know, what as best they can, I said, you know, how are the hummingbirds doing? And they said, I said, you know, is that 1,000 figure stable? And they just laughed. And I said, John, you know, that's that you're reading the official statistics. There's just 400 of them left. And we know that because we go out every year and find and count the nests. And after the birds have bred, the young birds come down to the shore, to the village where, you know, it's more temperate in the cooler months. And that's where the cats get them. And they said, you know, 20, 30 years, it's probably going to be extinct. And that was a really chastening moment because you realize that a lot of these things, you know, you ask, you know, what do we do about it? Well, short of really concerted effort and an enormous amount of money, probably, this stuff is probably just on a downward trajectory. So I don't want to sound really bleak because, you know, we've got to care and we've got to try and do stuff. Otherwise, you know, what's the point? But, you know, there are things which we are going to lose unless an awful lot of effort is put in. And, you know, people love the big sexy stuff. They like the pandas, the tigers. A little hummingbird on an island out of sight, out of mind. And that's, you know, that's kind of like the most colourful canary in the coal mine, because for every colourful hummingbird, there are 1,000 even less sexy invertebrates, which, you know, may be every bit as remarkable in their own way. And nobody knows, nobody cares. And this is, I think this is terribly sad.
Well, I hope that, I think a lot of people love hummingbirds, so maybe we can start a hummingbird movement, because I think also if we can protect hummingbirds, we'll be protecting a lot of other things as well.
Absolutely. The movement begins here.
Okay. Well, it's really great to talk with you, John. Thanks so much for being on Locus Focus.
My absolute pleasure, Barbara. Take care.
We've been talking with John Dunn, author of The Glitter in the Green, In Search of Hummingbirds. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Next week, we'll rebroadcast an interview I did in March with hydrologist and beaver advocate Suzanne Foudy. And for the rest of June, while I take some time off, we'll be re-airing some of the best of Locus Focus from this past spring and winter. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with the tune Hummingbird by Idu. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask. Hummingbird, you found.